involved in any type of saber activities. And my thanks to everybody and certain people who came up to me and said they were original members, and they thanked me, and I thank them, and I thank all of you for all the work that you've done through the years, through the decades, in advancing our thoughts about baseball and contributing so vitally to our love and understanding of the game. So my thanks to so many of you who have paved the way for those with open minds, and have paved the way for what has turned out to be a revolution within the industry itself. Let me introduce our panelists. First, you know Vince Gennaro, the president of Sabre and author of Diamond Dollars. He's been invaluable to us on our show, Clubhouse Confidential, on MLB Network that we do. And he also comes in and does other shows now, like The Rundown, and is brought in various cases just to really speak to valuation process, and obviously in also keeping us abreast of the coming wave of big data that is coming, that will also re-revolutionize the way we think about baseball. From Fangraphs, we have Bill Petty, who's also, we've been able to enjoy his work now on Fangraphs, and also contributes quite often to us with Clubhouse Confidential, and I'm sure many other shows around the country. I'm selfish, I just look at you when you're on my show, so I look at it that way. Also with us, we have one of the pioneers of statistical analysis. He co-founded Stats and has worked closely with future GMs Doug Melvin and Dan Evans way back in the day. He still contributes to RetroSheet, and again, one of the pioneers and the giants of the industry and analytics and baseball history, Dick Kramer. Let's hear it for Dick Kramer. See, now I asked for an applause for Matt Harvey and I got nothing, but I can ask for applause Dick Kramer. We're in the right group here. No actual baseball writers from the BBWA. If there is, yes, I'm taking a shot at you. Oh, yes. Thank you. I waited for your clapping. I just couldn't even. You had my back, though. Yeah, one guy that was also with us. Someone else who has just a lot of knowledge about how this all began in the early days of looking at baseball from a different perspective. He holds degrees from Penn and Temple. He also became the first statistician in three decades hired by a major league team. That was the Houston Astros in 1980. He wrote numerous books on stats and fantasy baseball. It was called Baseball Super Stats 1989, looking at the valuation of players. He's been involved in countless cases, arbitration cases, and actually arguing and going on both sides for player salaries and clubs, versions of player salaries. Welcome into our panel, Steve Mann. All right, Steve, I want to start with you, and take us back again, and I think even for the audience here, I'm sorry if this is, again, you know, just kind of boring or rudimentary for a lot of people who were there and understand where this came from, but I think it's instructive to a lot of people, especially the younger people here. What was the thought process in the 70s when you started looking at things and saying, is there a better way of doing this or evaluating players?
Well, first of all, there were no really useful statistics that had been hammered out yet. And the key to all statistics, essentially, is finding out how many runs a player is worth. The problem is you've got so many elements to deal with. Walks, singles, doubles, triples, home runs, groundouts, flyouts, strikeouts, the whole mess. How would you pull that apart and figure out where the runs came from? That's what we were looking for. Why were we looking for that? Because runs determine wins. Runs you score minus the runs you allow, your run margin pretty much matches up with your run-loss record, which makes perfect sense, but the question is, where do the runs come from? Now, in my case, I was not really a math guy, per se, and I was playing in a fantasy league, a game called APA, which is like Stratomatic. A lot of you probably know Stratomatic, based on probabilities and a pretty good replication of how the real stats work out. But still, no answer to the question, where do the runs come from? So in preparing for a draft in my fantasy league, I asked myself a simple question. Would I rather draft Pete Rose or Mike Schmidt? This was in the mid-70s. And I knew Rose was a batting average guy. He had a reputation as a good base runner. He walked a fair amount. He was not a home run hitter. And on the other side, you have Schmidt, strikes out a lot, walks a ton, hits a lot of home runs, and has a batting average about 50 points lower than Rose's. And I didn't know which of them created more runs. So I used a kind of a simple-minded approach to the whole thing. I simply went back through play-by-play data over one full season of Phillies play-by-play, which the club was kind enough to lend me. And I figured out what all of the events were worth. How much is a walk and a single, a double, a triple, a home run worth? And then you mix it all up and throw the player in there. And lo and behold, it had a really good match with actual run production by teams. So using this kind of simple-minded approach, I ended up with a pretty good stat, and I didn't think there was anything else like that around. I didn't know about Dick, the work that he had done, or that Pete Palmer had done before that. It wasn't publicized. So I thought, you know, I think I'm onto something here. And then one thing led to another and created a career for me. But that was the essential problem. Where do the runs come from? And Pete found his method in 1963. It's a thing called linear weights. I won't go into the horrible mathematical complexity of it. But essentially, it was another way of figuring out where the runs come from. And his was at a lower error rate than mine did. So he clearly had a better mousetrap for catching runs. And Dick, a few years later, created a thing called the batter's run average, and if you want to talk about that, obviously feel free. It was essentially on base and slugging, but it didn't really get completely worked out until Dick and Pete collaborated on it and turned it into what is now known and can be found everywhere on the internet, OPS Plus.
Well, Steve, let me stop you there then, because that's an excellent start. Dick, tell us your mindset, if you could, at first, when you started to recognize, hold on, maybe there's a better way here, and explain to us what your thoughts were at the time.
Well, I don't know how deep we want to get in the methodology. I would like to, I've had a lot of great adventures in this field, but the thoughts were, it was really curiosity. I remember being particularly, I was in school in Boston at the time, and Ted Williams, you know, of course, he was always either very popular or very unpopular, depending which columnist you read. But it seemed to me the notion that Ted Williams is not a clutch hitter and therefore was an inferior being. It didn't make a lot of sense to me, but still the Red Sox didn't win. So I was very interested in analyzing, trying to see whether if you added Ted Williams to any team, would he contribute the same number of runs? And having the formulas such as Steve described was sort of part of my thinking. The answer was simple curiosity. I'm a scientist, and we just tend to get questions in our mind that we, if we can possibly answer, we try to deal with them. The practical implications only came about later, and that's another story, but we can get that over time.
Excellent. Vince, maybe you just jump in on there. Let's stay in that kind of formative stages. When did you start looking at things and thinking, okay, and where did you jump in exactly?
Probably about 65, something like that. When 63, 64, 65, I too played at ball, and you get impressed right away with sort of the fundamental thing that we knew that the pros didn't know, that walks is to batters really made a whole lot of difference in how successful your team was. That was actually, that's an interesting point. It was only in the mid-1980s that if you want to know how many walks an individual batter got in the season, you had to wait until next spring and this morning news guy to find out.
Wow. Hold on, I'm writing that down. By the way, walks are still not taken seriously. I won't even get into that. All right, guys, when did you jump in, Mr. Gennaro, please?
You know, I actually had an early foray into it in the late 70s. I was in grad school at the University of Chicago, and I was really enamored with that intersection of economics and baseball. So my focus was less on measuring how runs were created, but taking some of the existing stats that were in play at the time in the late 70s and trying to convert them into a dollar valuation for players. And in fact, a lot of that work I reprised some 20 plus years later when I, actually closer to 30 years later, when I ended up writing Diamond Dollars, which focuses a lot on that. But I was really focused on, you know, what was the impact of wins on attendance and what was the impact of attendance on revenues, including the impact on ticket pricing. So that's where I waded in. And then I sort of left the baseball analytics world for a good part of three decades while I had a business career, and of course stayed deeply involved as a fan and joined Sabre in the mid-90s, but then came back in the early 2000s, about maybe 10, 12 years ago, when I really started to reconnect with the game analytically.
All right, since Bill, you're the kid of the group, when did you get into it, and when did you start examining things a little more closely?
So the short story is, I, like a lot of folks, you grew up, you stared at the numbers that are on the back of the ball, the baseball card, and you measured your favorite players, I think, as well as yourself, and you know, Little League, and, you know, growing up, start to play ball, and buy those numbers. And it was interesting, the first time that I had really heard anything outside of home runs, batting average, RBI, on the score, was my freshman year baseball game. Very interesting character. Somebody really should probably write a biography of him. He, at the end of the season, he produced these very complicated, reams of data on each of the players. And I mean, it's not all that different than if you were to go to, you know, Baseball Prospectus or Baseball Reference or Fangraphs these days and look at, you know, some of the, you know, the basic leaderboards. But it included things like on base percentage and slugging. And at the time, you know, myself and all, you know, my friends I grew up playing with, we didn't really understand what those stats were. You know, we liked them more because it said that, we said, well, is this good? Yes. Yeah, that's a high on base percent. That's good. So I was like, oh, great, I like this stat. As I do with but that was really the first time that we had been exposed to anything other than those traditional back of the baseball card types of statistics. But there was a big gap in terms of getting exposed to that, and me, I think, really digging into it, wanting to do something along those lines and asking deeper questions. For me, I spent, you know, years kind of tucking it away and, you know, just watching the game, playing the game without giving it much thought, really until I got to graduate school. And during the one summer of graduate school, I started reading Rob Nyer. And I think for a lot of folks, I don't want to say my age, maybe a little younger, a little older, Rob was a great kind of portal into this world of, you know, asking deeper questions about baseball, digging into more comprehensive numbers, thinking about things like linear weights, OPS plus, where for me growing up as a kid, I never heard these things before. You didn't get a trophy for highest OPS relative to the average. Which they would have given that now looking back, but that's not what they did. So for me, reading Rob was kind of that gateway into, like, I didn't read Bill LeVay, but I didn't read the work that was done in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, and Rob helped to kind of popularize that. And then once I started reading that, then I got hooked. And so for me, all through grad school, in my academic training, then it was, again, the same idea. It's like, well, can I come up with something different? Are there questions that I haven't been answered yet? That if I get my hands on enough data and apply some of the methodologies and the approaches that I learned to study, why countries go to war with each other, all those types of things, you take the same kind of methodology and apply it to this game where you've got better data and maybe come up with some new insights or maybe understand in a different way than you had before. And so I did that for a little while. It wasn't until really just 2 years ago that I started publicly writing about it. Some guy had the bad judgment to put me on television. And here I am. No,
it was based on looks alone.
Yeah.
Study groups said you rated very well.
Yeah. For me, it was funny. The first applied thing I did, it wasn't even analyzing Major League Baseball data. It was actually analyzing Little League data. A very good friend of mine was doing some work as a summer league coach in Newark. And he said to me that I want to do something different for these kids at the end of the season. They worked really hard. They put in a lot of effort. They didn't have a great season. It was a low-income area, and so they were playing against teams that had better resources. And I want to give them something extra. The record wasn't that great, but I want to give them something a little bit extra. And so I said, can you do anything outside of, I can tell them how many hits they got in batting average, but can you give me something else? And naively, I said, oh, sure. I know about all some of these new statistics now. And so I actually dug in on their data. We're talking about 17 games. But it was funny. It was it was a spark for me, because I was able to say to him, you know, without ever seeing your team play, you know, I can describe the tendencies of some of the players, and, you know, when they played really well, and what things they did that probably weren't so good, and how they could even change their approach. And he was like, it's amazing, you've literally never seen these kids, but you've almost described all of them to a T. And he was able to kind of take that back and talk to guys about, you know, in Little League, it's really important to put the ball in play, because, you know, think about the odds of ball being caught when you put the ball in play. They're really low compared to, you know, Major League Baseball. So little things like that where, you know, we talk to kids about their approach to the plate and why striking out at that level wasn't such a great idea and how much better they could be, because they said, look, I know that you're fast. The data shows that you're fast. You just don't get a chance to use your speed because you're striking out too much and not being patient. And for me, that was a bit of a spark, because it was taking something that, just numbers on a page, but delivering insights to my friend and thereby this kid, where, you know, it really gave him a little bit something extra. And you could do something and change the way people behave because of it. And from there on, I was kind of hooked, and that's where things took off for me. But that was what was really interesting.
So in the Sabre spirit of discovery, let the record show that Newark was the birthplace of Little League sabermetrics.
And as someone who lives in Montclair, we will make a nice offer. We want to speak to you and take you out for Newark and give you a nice permission, statistical analysis within Montclair Little League. That's tremendous. And, you know, statistics tell a language, right? Our language, and they tell a story. You can see each player just looking at his statistics. And that's fascinating. Even as you say that, I'm starting to think, wow, yeah, the better the fielding, the less important it is to hit for contact. And we're at a point now where a third of all offensive outcomes are the ball is not in play, which is another thing, but even just in this conversation, things are starting to make sense. Okay, so where are we now? Let's leap way forward. Dick, give us your idea of where you think we are now, given all these years and all these advances that we've had.
Well, it's a matter of, I think we're overriding technology. More technology means more data, and analysis starts with data. And some of you may have heard Layman's talk in just a session earlier today, and he drew graphs showing how much more data we're getting. And you may have heard Vince's talk, and Vince certainly gave a preview of how you can use this PitchFX data to learn deeper things. And frankly, it's a surprise to me. I kind of thought, at least at the level at baseball that I was doing analysis of, there wasn't much more to discover. But once you get more data, you know, there's more things that can happen. And so I expect we're going to learn a lot more. Another thing is we've always thought that there's always been an idea that you'd influence in-game strategy, and I think that will only happen really as you start analyzing in-game stuff, which is data, which is pitches, which is where the batter and pitcher tendencies and so forth. So the bottom line is I think, much to my surprise, this field is about ready to explode again.
Steve, where do you think we are right now?
I think Dick summarized it pretty clearly. I met Dick in 1980. I had known Pete Palmer for a short time before that. The three of us started working on what became the Edge 1000 system, the first play-by-play computer system. This was for the Oakland A's. Then Pete and I did another system a couple of years later for the Braves and the Phillies. The Braves used theirs for at least 10 years. I think the Phillies were still using my thing for 15 years or something like that. And essentially what it did was it enabled you to take the play-by-play data and add to it the eyeball observations of professionals up in the press box, looking at where the batted balls were hit, and marking down on a piece of paper exactly where on the field they believe that ball either made contact with the fielder or hit the ground or hit the wall or whatever. And so we just started to get the stuff that would be useful somewhere down the road. But it was very broad, and it was just eyeball observations. It wasn't at all precise. When we built our system, when Pete and I built our system for the Braves and the Phillies, I made it clear to both clubs, this is not going to be anywhere near the final answer on this stuff. This is just the first order of approximation. We're not going to be able to turn this stuff into real fielding values, which is the next great thing to be discovered is how many runs is the fielder worth? Meaning, how many more runs does he prevent than the average fielder at his position? It's a very complex matter. And we started the process, but even then, 30 years ago, we knew this was just a kind of a sloppy beginning to the whole thing. Leap forward to now, to Sport Vision and HitFX, Pitch FX, and this stuff that's going on. That's the future, and it's happening now. And right now, as I understand it, Vince, there are five clubs that are on board with that system?
Well, there's five installations of Field FX, which is the camera-based system that described what you were talking about, which measures every movement on a field of all, of everything alive, essentially. Probably including that cat that ran across in 1969, that black cat. But yes, you know, we're really at an inflection point, I think, right now, because it's the combination of the explosion of data, the innovative technologies that we have, both in data capture and in the analytics side, and also the reduced expense of storage capability, data storage capability. You look at those three things in combination, it's the perfect storm of taking us on a trajectory like this in terms of analysis. You know, and Sean talked about it in his presentation, I don't think you mentioned this specifically, but as I looked at the improvement or increase in the data, I believe there's about 50 times more data today on the historical record of what happened during games than there was in the book Moneyball's written. Think about that. The book Moneyball was written 10 years ago with 2%, and it was based on a history that included 2% of the data that we have today. So we're in the process of really, I think, having the ability to lap some of the early learnings of Moneyball. The thought process will be the same, it's just that we'll be applying those thoughts to a much more robust database with much more advanced analytics and an ability to process it very quickly.
Bill, where are we now with what you, because I know you study this stuff on a regular basis.
Yeah, no, what I think is interesting is if you look at the path that I think baseball in general, both from a fan's understanding of the game as well as how clubs are trying to leverage data and better evaluate players. If you think about that trajectory, I think it mirrors most organizations. If you think about this also in the business world, which is what I do from a day job perspective. And I think it's interesting. It's not that these questions haven't been asked before or they're only being asked now, but there was a significant ceiling or limit into, this is a great question, I'd love to answer it, but I literally cannot answer it given the limitations in access to data, in computing power, and so many of these types of limitations. And so the questions kind of get pushed aside or scrolled away, and when executives, whether they're heads of ball clubs or heads of organizations and businesses, are asked, where do you want to invest money in? What questions would you like to be able to answer? The next question, what's it going to cost me to understand this phenomenon? Whether it's why customers behave the way they do, or who's a more valuable hitter, Pete Rose or Mike Schmidt? How much is it going to take to really be able to answer that question? And until the costs come down, they're so manageable, for the most part, those things can be pushed aside. What's this too much money? It's too blue sky. I can't answer the question. And so you get kind of the what and the when type of data. So I know, with baseball for so many years, we had tons of what and when data. I mean, RetroSheet really helped to pull this together for a larger community. And now what we're able to do with this new sensor type of technology is answer more the how and the why. So I know what happened from an outcome standpoint. Matt Harvey struck out 13 batters, right? Many of us don't have been very happy about that. How did he do it, though? So everyone can accomplish that in a very different way. And depending upon how he did that, we can make different inferences about, how reliable is that going to be going forward? Can he do that against most teams? Is he one of the more dominant guys that can strike out, 8 to 13 batters on a regular basis? Because we can see the velocity of his pitch, the degree of his break on the ball, his pitch location. That how and the why comes, I think, is where you couldn't answer those questions because the technology wasn't there to be able to track and get the data reliably and crunch the numbers. But now, because of changes in computing power, we're finally to a point where we can do that. And when I think about this, too, I think about, scouting, right? Scouts have always been trying to be able to put some kind of a number on what they see. This player has, 70 power versus this player that has 40 power. Well, now we can even go deeper and dig into those numbers. So when I say somebody has 70 power, well, how do I know that he actually has 70 power? Is it just based upon my experience? Well, yes, we can add that in, but now we can actually look at how far does the ball actually travel off the bat? What is the launch angle? What is the launch velocity? And then be able to compare that. So you're just able to dig into a much more granular level than we ever have been able to do before. And I think if you look at most of the most clubs that are out there, you know, on average, there is a desire to do that because you can make much better decisions, you can better evaluate players, especially younger ones, if you've got that level of data and that level of detail. Whereas if you stay at a too abstract a level, it's a bit fuzzy. And so I think we really are entering kind of another golden age of you know, of analysis around baseball and data, because mostly not necessarily driven by the questions we're asking, but the technology has finally caught up to the questions after.
Well, I think even with pitching, right, is that if you bring up Matt Harvey, you say, wow, what a breaking ball. Well, how hard was it being thrown? What was the tilt? What was the angle? What was the break? And that now, this could be told right now, right?
How many rotations? Because again, we know that, you know, break is partly a function, you know, now Nathan's here, probably coming along, and then probably am, but it's partly a function of rotations you're able to create over that 60-foot, you know, or less, you know, distance. And again, we'd never be able to really track that. But now we can. Now we would have loved to die if we would be able to have this technology for, you know, for Pedro Martinez when he was in his prime. Can only imagine what he was able to do in that way. We can guess at it, we can estimate it, but now we're in a position where we can actually verify that empirically, which is just, again, in and of itself, I think, is very
good. It brings up some fascinating points, including, you know, you bring up Pedro, who recently just had a thing back and forth. One of my old producers at ESPN said, giving the most dominant single season pitching performance. And it boiled down to Pedro 1999 versus Pedro 2000.
Yeah.
And then it was like, okay, but one was actual run suppression, and the other was more strikeouts, more runs allowed. But then, you know, as I've been told, it's like, yeah, but that was batted driven, and then there's the home runs, the fly ball ratio. And so, but yeah, then there's the difference. So, Dick, let me start with you. What is the difference between what actually happened and what should have happened? Or what would you project to happen? Or if you want to answer, Pedro 99 or 2000?
I'll leave Pedro to the current Red Sox fans, but he's obviously a terrific, extraordinary pitcher. One of the things we have to keep in mind is signal versus noise. And again, the guy out of our community, Nate Silver, has written a book that any of you have the slightest interest in this topic should devour. It's a very high quality book and involved with a good press. And that. But just think about this experiment. Suppose I give you a coin and ask you to flip it 162 times. If it can flip 90 heads, you won't be surprised. Even if it's an honest coin, probably. But, of course, 90 wins out of 162 tries gets you in the playoffs a lot of the time. So luck is always with us, and the signal versus the noise is something you do have to take into account all the time. I think what's going to happen, you've heard data is terrific from all of us, but the other side of that is some of that data is probably irrelevant. But the bottom line is, until you have data to analyze, you don't know which data are relevant or not. So it still starts with data. You need that to make progress. A couple thoughts there, but.
You know, one of the things I'm finding, and it's isolated, every team is different, of course, is that in a dialogue with some teams, I feel like they have not caught up yet with the increased power of the data and the computing power. So they're framing their questions in more of the way they used to frame them, in a rather conservative way, in a rather limited and simplistic way, when in reality we can be asking much more sophisticated questions we never thought we could ask. Well, we always asked them conceptually, we debated them, but we never thought there was a numerical answer. Now there is. For example, you know, how does this guy handle a changeup as a batter? Well, why don't we look at that as a function of pitch sequences? Because maybe he handles changeups far better when they're following this kind of pitch versus that kind of pitch, or this kind of location versus that kind of location. And he's actually had a disproportionate mix of those locations, and that's why he doesn't look like his changeup well, or he looks like he does hit the changeup well, whatever. So now we're able to ask a question and peel it back two or three layers and really add some texture to it and understand, you know, at a much higher level. And it's not easy for baseball people, even those who have been, you know, are involved in the analytics side of baseball, to necessarily gravitate to asking the questions that are big enough to take advantage of the power that we have now.
Fizz, I have a question then. Is every club on its own to purchase this and then analyze it on their own, or how does that HitFX, PitchFX then get to clubs? How does it operate right now?
Well, you know, PitchFX is available to everyone, all clubs, and by the way, it's in the public domain as well, but I'm sure it comes to the clubs in a more you know, user-friendly format. So the PitchFX data is there. PitchFX measures all 720,000 pitches. It measures about 20 things for each pitch: release point, vertical and horizontal, pitch movement, pitch location, trajectory, and the list goes on and on, speed, etc. What's next is the HitFX data, which is derived from the same cameras. That is purchased by the teams. And many teams today, although not all, by the HitFX data. HitFX measures the bat ball contact. It measures the speed and velocity and horizontal and vertical launch angles that the ball comes off the bat. This allows you to be able to say that when a batter is hitting, well, when Puig was hitting, or maybe Iglesias is a better example, hitting what he was hitting at the beginning of this year, you can look at the actual diagnostics of his batted balls to realize that he was quite lucky and fortunate in terms of his outcome. The third component of this is field effects. Now, field effects is the one that measures every movement on the field. It will certainly give us deeper insights into defense and base running, two areas that will really become, I think, much better known with this information. This is only in five ballparks today. I'm not current on MLB's plans to expand this at what pace, but until it's in 30 ballparks, it's really not going to be a factor on a large scale.
Which five fields? Do we know?
Tampa, Kansas City.
San Francisco, Milwaukee, and Boston. Well, how about that? Yeah. So that's an advantage, isn't it?
I would think so.
Yeah, Tom?
Okay. Data is not being shared really at this point. It's almost like it's more in pilot form to work out the bugs of the data capture, as opposed to being a true source of data, which is what it stands to become.
And let's ratchet it back then, Steve. I know we've been looking for this stuff for a long time, right? Tell us about, we were just talking about trying to figure out what I would call frozen rope percentage, or the sweet spot as you would describe, right? You're trying to look at this stuff long, long ago.
Oh, no, we weren't trying to look for it, but we anticipated that one day, as today is the day, you'd be able to isolate that roughly one half or one dime on the baseball, which is where you need to hit it, and the one half or one quarter on the bat, the so-called sweet spot, where you need to get the ball, or where you will hit the ball hardest, the center of percussion on the bat. That's where the whole game really happens, is in that little place where the round bat meets the round ball. And so, I don't know if we're here yet, but at some point you may even be able to help a batter change his mechanics slightly so that he's getting it on a better part of the sweet spot. I mean, we're not talking about taking it to the nth degree. I don't know if that's ever really going to happen, but that actually is where the game of baseball takes place, is at that moment.
And let me follow up then, and I forgot I'm taking notes furiously here. Then Iglesias was found to not have enough sweet spot hits to have had the outcomes that he had, therefore does not transferable, will not occur in the future, correct?
Correct. That's the inference. Yes, that's the inference we're making. And again, this is still a small body of work, right? A half season of his efforts. So a lot remains to be seen. But you know, I think what you're saying, Steve, and I wonder if at some point we're not going to distill this all down to wind. Because I mean, it sounds funny because you know you're talking about the level of precision we're somewhat aspiring to, and I don't mean that in a literal sense because not everybody's going to use this information the way it seems like we would. But literally, when you start talking about physical spaces this small, The wind ultimately could be the differentiator.
We're going to do this, collect your own questions. We're going to do this for about 20 minutes. We'll chat a little bit more, and then we're going to open it up to questions. And please get your questions ready. Make them questions. Actual questions. We have an opportunity here to ask and find things out. And I'll throw out a question here then when I'm looking to. Yes, Steve.
I just wanted to make a comment. Most of what Vince is talking about is not so much evaluation of performance in terms of preventing runs. That's the fielding side of it. All this other stuff with the pitching and the hitting is diagnostic and instructional. You're trying to find out why does a guy succeed or fail, whether he's a pitcher or a hitter. And so there's a world of information that's going to be available here. And our experience with the Braves and the Phillies, and I imagine Dick's with Oakland and other folks with other system users, like when I left Houston, I said to Tal Smith, we're going to try to get more clubs involved in this. I said, are you worried about confidentiality? He said, no, I don't really care who has the data because it's what you do with it. That's the problem, because most front offices don't really have much of a clue about what to do with this beam of material. And I'm not putting them down, it's very hard to deal with. It's complex.
Go ahead.
I was really impressed in one of the talks earlier today, seeing players very intently looking at their iPads and realizing that at the end of the day, it's a question whether the players do or do not react to this, and of course, if it means more money for them and more recognition, and they can see how to do it, they're going to do it. Why wouldn't you?
That's another part of the revolution is that the players are going to be very adept at this. It affects them directly. And it really is just part of the scouting and yet the analysis of it, but they need that instant feedback. I've seen a number of things through what the players do see, Bloomberg or other places. What are players looking at today? Vince, Bill, maybe you can jump in on this. What are actual players looking at when they go in and see what just either happened then at bat or looking at past performances against a particular pitcher?
Well, this is directly from Sean's presentation a few hours ago, and that is this whole notion of the role that video plays and the speed and turnaround time. The video component of a baseball organization is a critical one, but it's becoming even more important. And Bloomberg Sports has an app that allows a pitcher, and I've seen, C.J. Wilson's screen. So you dial in at C.J. Wilson, and he buys the service from Bloomberg Sports, and he's going to face the Yankees that day. He can call up Cano, Gardner, and everybody write down that lineup and look at the last X number of times he faced them. Look at all. He can call up and look at 3-2 counts only. And it's retrievable. We're literally talking in terms of seconds. So all this, that kind of information is all about preparation. So, the days of the guys rolling in the clubhouse, a couple hour before the game and, getting a little bit loose and then getting out there and having at it, those days are long gone. Now we're talking about the science of preparation for what you're about to do that day and the seriousness and the information which is there to support it.
Bill?
Yeah, I haven't had as much direct exposure to sort of what players have seen, but just from talking to people, seeing what's coming out, there's been presentations by Bloomberg Sports. They do have greater access and maybe more immediate access to this, to not just the video information, but then the data behind it. But I think, and this is where I do think there's a lot of work to be done, not in terms of research, but in terms of practically how do players and how do front offices use the data. So I think what was said earlier was very important. Just having data isn't necessarily in of itself a good thing. I always kind of, when people talk about, statistics, there's three kinds of statistics. There's lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics. And I always say, no, statistics don't lie, but people do. Or we can fool ourselves in terms of how we interpret and use the statistics. And so I think there is an honest conversation that has to happen in terms of just having that access. How much better does that actually make the players, right? Because if I'm CJ, and I have no idea if CJ Wilson does this, but let's use him as an example. He goes on, he pulls up data and says, the last 20 at-bats, the last 20 plate appearances against Robinson Cano, he's 8 for 20 off of me, with 4 extra base hits. So, I got to be very careful. Well, not necessarily, right? That's 20, it's a sample of 20. And so, to an untrained person or just somebody who's not as experienced, you can draw very wrong conclusions from the data. And so I think that goes for players, it goes for fans, but also goes for front offices. So it's beyond just having the data and having the insights to come to you, but there's also almost like a cultural shift that has to happen within the clubhouse and within the front office around, I talk about this in my day job, but how do you instill a great data culture? One that not only embraces the use of data in terms of decision making, but also understands the proper way to use that data so that you don't just use it to make decisions, but you use it to make better decisions and ideally don't hurt yourself in terms of the use of that. I think that's still something that teams and players are grappling with, and that's really where it can become problematic, because now you're opening up the file, you're opening up the fire hose of information. And so the longer it takes for you to get that kind of culture instilled, the proper way to use this data. With all this new information coming at you, I can see it having some negative effects on not just players, but also front office. And so that's a critical thing for me that I'm interested in watching how that unfolds. Because the same thing's happening in non-baseball business world. Happens every single day. There's a lot more data coming to executives. Are they actually making better decisions based upon that? It's still a big question mark. I'd say it's a coin flip in most companies.
And this is really the intersection of scouting and data, because it's probably a bad example for data, because I think it's more of a scouting tool. And this is a situation where what C.J. Wilson's focused on is when he throws his breaking ball that Cano can't handle, what is the position that Cano is from the plate and the setup? How is his front foot tilted and where is his weight distributed? So that when he sees those cues when he was back out there, then he knows he's probably vulnerable with breaking ball. So it's more than looking, it's not looking at the 8 for 20, it's looking at the physical cues.
And something I've heard from a lot of, on the show on MLB Now, we do get a lot of good interviews with assistant coaches, and guys in front offices. And I think I hear, and probably anybody who's working for a club here would know better about how it interfaces, because I just know what they tell me and picking up snippets of what could be true through the conversations. I hear a lot about quadrants, and I wonder if that's just an easy way, because again, for a player, it has to be digestible information that you can act on fast with your muscle and your reflexes. I wonder if what they're looking at now is to simplify and tell guys there are quadrants you can hit. Is that a result of heat maps and just looking for kind of the old Ted Williams of pitch here, not here, and oversimplifying, but getting much more sophisticated analysis within that and training guys where it could go within any matchup?
Yeah, I mean, in my view, yes. I mean, I don't think that we can break down, so if you're looking at the kind of pitch impacts, just simply to say, if I cluster a certain set of pitches in this area, fastballs in the upper right-hand part of the strike zone, whether it's the textbook strike zone or whether it's the Mike Fast strike zone in terms of what tends to be called, what actually happens? Or what is the result? And so, there's a high on-base percentage based on pitches that are swung at in that area, that's going to light up more than an area that's been in the way. The borders that we draw are, I don't want to say they're completely arbitrary, but you could slice the strike zone up into two quadrants. You could slice it up into six. You could slice up into 16, 64. There comes a point where those lines do become somewhat arbitrary, and so, and with more sophisticated software, there are no lines. It's literally just, you can create, it almost looks like abstract art in terms of, and you see these on the scan a lot. Mark Simons would beat that quite a bit. Those heat maps that aren't, quadrant-based or geometric, but they are just those kind of swirls. But how digestible is that? I think that's a great point. And this goes back to how do you use the information effectively. You do have to make it digestible, not just to folks in the front office, but to coaches and to players. And the more abstract the data seems to be, I think the less useful it will be. But there's going to be a trade-off, right? So the more simplistic you can try to make the data, the more digestible, there's some nuance that gets left out. And so I think that there is an art to how do you present the data in a way where it's digestible, but you don't leave out too much nuance where you can make a bad decision based upon those 8 quadrants or those 16 quadrants.
See, this is interesting, because I think now this is a good example of a point where we are today versus I think where we're headed. And the thing that I don't like about quadrants in the way we're talking about them, and they are being used that way, is they're static. So, I mean, you're not going to, I'm sorry, maybe I'm being closed-minded, but you're not going to convince me that a guy can't handle a pitch in a certain place. These are elite athletes. Because it depends a lot on what he's prepared to hit and what his expectation is. So looking at, can still call them quadrants, but looking at them in a two or three pitch sequence is, I think, where you start to mine real value as opposed to looking at things statically versus dynamically. So I agree with everything Bill said, actually, but my point is that I think it doesn't help your point on the complexity, because it probably adds complexity, but I think we need to get to a point where we can make digestible information that we're providing today that isn't static, that's dynamic, that's in the flow of the game.
You know, to hear it here first, that's a, to me, strikes me as quite important.
I'm sorry, did you say it?
I think what Vin said is very new and very important. That every pitch comes after another pitch, and it's a sequence that gets people out.
I think, and I find with the, you know, the better minds that I work with, and through the way I've worked with, you know, Buck Showalter and Larry Boa, who was here, and they're always asking those questions. It's not shooting down Sabre metrics. It's looking at it, saying, yeah, but what about this? What about this? Which is all the things that we're talking about. Yeah, you have to be able to know how to use that or not, as long as they're not just shooting it down, which is probably the old way. There's still some who probably do that, Steve.
There's also, there's been a period, at least the last 20 years, where there's been some science going on off to the side that's not directly related to these systems. I ran into a guy from Drexel University, a professor, actually his son, explained to me that his father had developed a batting speed measurement device, a cable that you attach to the bat. And it could measure not only the bat speed of the bat going through the zone at something like 60,000 cycles per second, but also your swing speed. Now, what does that mean? Well, before you actually attack the ball, there's movement going on. Some batters are more than others. You might see a big hitch or some little movement, but before they launch the bat, they're already starting to swing. That is factored into how quickly you can respond to a pitched ball. So that technology has been here for 20 years. We showed it to the Orioles. Frank Robinson really liked it when we put on a display there. I was just there for the ride. And so you had that. And then there's been another kind of science. This is Frank Joe. You may all have heard of Frank Joe. He's the original Tommy John elbow surgery guy. This is about 25 years ago. He planted electrodes all over the bodies of professional batters, because he wanted to know, where does the swing come from? Where is the power generated? And by having all these electrodes on the batter, you could find out it was very clear cut, and it applied to everybody. It all starts with your back leg, from the hamstring through your midsection is where most of the muscle activity is occurring during a baseball swing. What your upper body and your arms do is pretty much after the fact. It's sort of guiding the bat through the zone, but all of the power comes from down here. So if you're going to be training people to become more powerful, you're going to have to deal with the mechanics of their bodies that don't connect up to this kind of, you know, tracking every batted ball and that sort of thing. This is a whole different avenue of science in baseball. And I think all of these things are going to coalesce as front offices become more scientific in their thinking. It's useful.
That's fascinating, and that's another part of the other part of it. What is, there's the analyzing of it, and then there's the performance maximization. It's two very different things. It brings to mind. So Dick, I'm looking. I finally saw some good footage of Stan Musial, and I thought he swung the bat that way. So there, and as I see, even Bryce Harper has sort of a different way of getting his load up to the front part. Tell, now, again, with your experience, the years that you've seen, there's a lot of ways of doing this, isn't there?
There sure are, and I think most of us here look at the historical perspective with a great deal of interest, how these things have changed over time. But, of course, we all know that you know, you see pitchers wind up in the 1930s, and they have this enormous, elaborate leg kick and everything. I saw somebody recently, I forget whom, was trying that only with at runners on base. Again, I think with all this, we're all learning all the time, and we can learn from what happened 50 years ago and 100 years ago, give us new food for thought. And if you go back 100 years ago, it was all new to everybody. It wasn't like there were these ways you do things. For a long time, baseball was sort of dominated by the ways we do things. In a way, the statistical analysis has been part of the driving force to get us out of that. And it's really sort of ironic that how Moneyball has actually become to like a mantra for the rest of the world. Do Moneyball, be virtuous, which is pretty extreme, I think. But still, I think there is a lesson there to learn, you know, and to take history, getting back to Brian's question, as a guide for other things you might try. There aren't any rules out here, it's just what we discovered.
I'm just digesting that. Excellent. It is amazing. I think all of us have used the lessons of baseball and what we call sabermetrics just as critical thought in all aspects of life. Bill, you put that to use on an everyday basis. Can anybody do a Stan Musial swing? Where's the batting stance guy when you need him? And the Musial swing was, can anyone describe it? It's where he was, you know, back behind here.
Yeah.
And
extremely close.
Go ahead, what did it look like? Dennis, come on. It's Dennis Corcoran, he was going to do a little Stan Musial swing for us. I know you don't have to do it perfect, but better than I will anyway. Yeah, like that, perfect.
Except, home plate, you have to your right somewhere.
Well, that was the stance. And anyway, if you watched a guy hit, and if you show someone who's 20 years old, hey, look at this old guy hit, you'd say, what, you know, he couldn't have been any good. And just a different way of doing things. Are there other things where, when you look at it, and guys say high leg kick in the 30s, I wonder, batters in the 20s, if we're reverting back to, okay, now maybe we want more contact from the scooteros of the world, maybe that's more slump-proof, I wonder if we could learn things from the guys who did make more contact, and maybe it wasn't just that they had a bat this thick, like a table leg.
Yeah, Mike Schmidt wrote a truly excellent book on hitting mechanics called Mike Schmidt's Study, I think it's about 15 years ago. And he pointed out that the batters from way back used very heavy bats. They typically range from like 35 ounces to 45 ounces. Today it's more like 30 to 33 ounces. Okay? So Schmidt pointed out that in order for them to get to the zone, back up, that is great. Slide.
See, we have a show here too, folks. We're getting crazy.
There are two guys with hitting approaches. One is called weight shift, which is where you take a pretty good stride and then turn. And then there's pure rotation, where you just turn immediately. This is what most batters do today. But in the old days, you had this big, heavy bat. And Schmidt pointed out the only way you could get that thing through the zone with some authority was to put some momentum into your stride so that you get things started and then you return on it. Now, that typically hurts your back over a long period of time and is less efficient than a purely rotational swing. So the kinds of bats that you're definitely wrong. And Babe Ruth and only a handful of other guys could wield those things and get them around quick. That's why you only had a handful of home run hitters. But once they started moving toward lighter bats, the batters moved more toward the rotational approach. And George Brett and Charlie Lau are among the last of the people who've been advocating for any kind of weight shift. It's not good for your hitting and it's not good for your body. So it took a long time for that to be worked out.
Fascinating. And I often wonder too, there's only been a few other baseball cultures, obviously coming from the U.S., but when Ichiro came about and said, well, you can't do that, well, why can't you do that? But he didn't learn that you had to do it this way. Any thoughts on that, Dick, and baseball cultures? Because even Cuban baseball, I often bring up, I saw Cuban baseball, and I brought this up on my shows a number of times, that a guy walked two batters in the second inning. Out he goes. We're here to win this game, and that was it. It opened my eyes to, you don't have to let them labor out there for six innings and get lit up or give up four or five runs. Go get the guy. What can we learn from either cultures or challenging the orthodox thinking?
One of the things which has always intrigued me is, Jack, how popular baseball is in Japan, because they're such a team-oriented, you know, we have a team spirit, we do things with the team and so forth, and yet baseball is probably one of the most individualistic of team sports. That's an irony that's always struck me. The thought that comes to mind as you ask that question, I think that, again, just to reiterate what I said in a very complicated way, I think you try to learn from anything that's new and different and see if there's something that applies to your situation, and keeping that frame of mind is the way you make progress and learn things, in my experience.
I have one last question for the panel, just a little topic, and then get your questions ready. Please, let's get them going. We can spend a good half hour on your questions and bounce things around. When you measure pitching right now, and it gets back to Pedro 99 versus Pedro 2000, and even now when you look at, hey, there's a bunch of guys who have great fielding and suspended pitching, who are supposed to be good or the best. Max Scherzer, you know, is one of them, and yet there are other guys who are just much better on a regular basis in their basic run suppression. How do we judge pitchers? How should we judge pitchers when we're trying to find the finer points between Scherzer, Kuroda, or Kershaw, Matt Harvey, and that sort of thing, especially when you have one guy who is missing more bats, the other guy who's allowing fewer runs? Anybody at all?
Ask your question again.
What are you believing more in? The runs allowed or the fielding independent pitching? Meaning what you are supposed to be responsible for, your walks, strikeouts, home runs.
Okay. The nexus, the core of this problem is batted balls in play. Right? The reason they're going to these walks and homers and strikeouts is because the ball isn't put in play in the field of play. And in 2001, January of 2001, a guy named Boris McCracken wrote an article, did a little study, about, I think it was a two-year sample, that said, all those balls that are hit in fair play are just random. They're just random events. Some are hit, some are not. It's just pure luck. Okay. 6 months later, Tom Tippett, who's a very highly respectable and admirable researcher from the Boston area, did a study, I think it was like a 80-year sample, so it was much more useful information to be working with. And what he found was, of course pitchers have an effect on how hard balls are hit into the field of play. So typically power pitchers like a Nolan Ryan or a Roger Clemens would have fewer balls hit hard in play. They gave up more home runs, but generally speaking, they hit the end of the bat or below the sweet spot, and got good results. And then there were other kinds of pitchers who got good results in Tom Tippett's study, knuckleball pitchers. There were even some basic off-speed pitchers like a Jamie Moyer who did perfectly well. So the point is, it's ridiculous to regard every batted ball as just a random event.
Well, Steve, let me stop you for a second. I want Bill to weigh in on that first. I'm glad you said nice things about Tom since he's sitting right there. I happen to have Marshall McLuhan with me right now. Yes. Bill, you want to weigh in on the course of a practice study?
Here's how I look at it. And all right, this may get too abstract, and I apologize, but when I was in graduate school, there was a big debate in the social sciences generally. There was always this big split between social sciences and the natural sciences and the hard sciences, right? So the idea that things work in systems that were very precise and that made things predictable made perfect sense if you were talking about the atomic level, right? So we could predict with a lot of certainty where atoms would move to, how they would react. This allowed us to make predictions about, in an astrophysical level, we know what planets are going to be, we know where this asteroid is going to be, is it going to hit us or not? Not necessarily certain, because level of certainty, but almost. Then there's the social sciences, and because it involves people, we're just messy. We mess everything up. We're unpredictable. We're more random. And there was an article written by great social scientist named Gabriel Allen, and he wrote an article, I think it was in '68, called Clouds, Clocks, and Political Science. And he was basically riffing off of Karl Popper, which most everyone at some point has if they're in academia, but with this concept of, you know, when you're trying to think about how well you can create science of something, something that's more, you know, quantitative in nature and very predictable versus something that's just mushier and softer and harder to do, you could think about where could you place that thing, that activity, on a continuum where on one hand you have regular clock-like systems that are predictable, and not only do they move in a predictable fashion, but we can study them in that way, versus things that are more cloud-like. They're more nebulous, they're amorphous, they change very radically, and it's very hard to predict what they're going to do and way into the future. So when I think about pitching, to me, I just go back to this idea of clouds and clocks, right? So if you think about, you know, batting average on balls in play, on a game-to-game basis and even on a year-to-year basis, it can appear more cloud-like, right? These things do, you know, from a pitcher-to-pitcher standpoint and year-to-year standpoint, they tend to vary somewhat wildly, some more than others, but you do see lots of variation. It's harder to predict a pitcher's batting average on balls in play in year two just based upon what they did in year one. Much harder than if you're going to predict how many strikeouts they're going to have or walks they're going to have in year one versus year two. Again, relatively speaking. However, if you stretch out the time frame on batting average on balls in play, and you look at it from a career standpoint, you absolutely do begin to see that separation. And the way I think about it is, it's not that there's one single metric or one single way of evaluating pitching. It's to what extent can you make a phenomenon like batting average on balls in play that on a short time frame is more cloud-like, does maybe appear to be more random, and make it more clock-like. And some things in baseball, like pitching, you've got to extend the time frame. And so I think people that are more focused on or rely more on things, you know, again, you know, Boris had dips, it's since been updated to fielding independent pitching in the fifth. One of the reasons people like that so much is it takes something like pitching and pitching outcomes, which is more cloud-like, makes it more clock-like. Home runs allowed, walks, strikeouts on a year-to-year basis, that is, relative to other metrics, that's as certain as you're going to get, as cloud-like as you may be able to get year-to-year. And so for a short time frame, they like that. That doesn't mean that you should only look at that. You could look at it, you know, then look at the runs allowed, look at the team's defense, look at, over a two-year sample, how well does a given pitcher do. To me, I wish I could make it a simple answer, and I know I'm sometimes very bad at making things simple, but to me, it's not a matter of do you do dips or do you do ERA, it's just understanding what the limitations are and what you can infer in shorter time frame versus longer time frames. That makes any sense.
Yeah, Vince, if you can top that, good luck.
I talk about signal versus noise, and we're in the area where signal and noise kind of blur together. And on the question that Tom and Steve were talking about, to me, I think the truth is somewhere in between. We were really surprised to find out that pitchers had so little influence on the outcome of balls in play, but they do have some.
You know, I think two misses of either of those systems, FIP or ERA or whatever the conventional metrics are, there's two things that they both neglect and ignore that I think are worthy of consideration. The first is the quality of the opposition. We do not face a homogeneous opposition. From the work that I've done this year, the 143 starting pitchers that are, quote, qualified over a certain threshold of appearances, starting pitchers now, Matt Harvey has pitched against the weakest competition of all 143. Not by much, by 3.5% below the league average. If you look at the OPS of the lineups he's faced. So if somebody else is 3.5% on the other side, now we're talking about 7% of the point differential in who the batters were that this guy faced. So that's point one that I would make. The second is, and this is a curious, this is an interesting one, because we measure a pitcher by what he does when he's on the mound. We give a lot less credit to how long he stays on the mound. And one of the profound impacts of a starting pitcher is how deep he pitches into a game. And so in my system that I rank starting pitchers, that's a very significant factor, is innings pitched per start. If you look at who typically comes in the sixth inning, it's not your best reliever. You look at who comes in the fifth inning, even worse. So giving pitchers credit for how deep they pitch in their games, I think, is something that none of the measures that are conventional at least talk about.
Well, we got through a lot. That was pretty good. Let's open it up to questions now. And now you can get involved. So if anyone wants to raise, now people are lining up right there. And I would ask everybody,
Just keep it tight. Like, this is something I can learn from, right, on TV. Keep it tight. Actually ask a question or you'll be drummed out of here. So go ahead, sir.
Well, I'm not going to ask a question. I actually want to correct the historical record, Steve's. Fairly certain the first person to have a counter-argument to Burroughs was not by Carly Tom, but myself, Eric Bain, on Newsnet. In the dialogue with Burroughs, I showed that guys who changed teams mid-season, once you included the makeup of their teammates, old team and new team, did a regression analysis, that makeup was predictive, even within one season. So, and the irony, of course, that Tom, Burroughs, and I were all simultaneously employed by Red Sox as consultants. That record is on Newsday. People will look up my posts. But I also want to, I thought Bill made a phenomenal point about the data culture, getting a good data culture in clubhouses, and I thought I'd give an anecdote there. I discovered that Michael Owen was extraordinarily good throughout his career after Dead Off, and conversely, extraordinarily bad when he had just come off the airplane, every time, first game in a new city without a day off.
All right, you gotta ask your question.
Okay, go ahead, let's just...
No, you go, really go. No, go, ask, please.
Okay, I've got the question, okay. So when I passed this information on to the Red Sox, I knew that we had a different idea.
Thank you, guys. All right, thank you, let's hear it. Thank you.
Yes,
go ahead, please ask your question. We're only got 20 minutes. Let's do it.
Hi, FX Flynn. I
want to
know when I'm
going to
get my royalties from Pitch FX. No, that's not
true. This is not the area of
grievances.
When did this happen? Go ahead.
Right. Any concern that the end result of being able to provide training, the best possible training, the highest possible level, is going to so homogenize baseball that we are simply going to have games that are effectively random number generators, just as some would argue happens now. And we know that's not the case, because there's a vast difference in skills, in approaches, so on and so forth. I see what's happening in golf, not because of the equipment change so much, but because of the training, because of the ability for golfers to hone their swings, the perfect game. So it's not something you can do in baseball because of the pitch of that of quantification. But just a concern that we might be heading for an era, you know, in 20 or 30 years, where baseball is very homogenous, and then there's going to have to be another change, maybe 60 or 70 years in the future.
That's a good question. All right, let's stop you there. That's a good question. How about that?
We need stars, I think, and that's the worry. We don't have stars, but just a bunch of players. That's the challenge.
Yeah, I totally reject the idea that players will become homogenized and that they'll all be the same. One thing is clear throughout every facet of this stuff, whether you're looking at performance or salaries or anything else, no two players are alike, no two people are alike. They're going to have different strengths and weaknesses. And so you don't have to worry that the scientists are going to turn them all into some kind of robots.
You know what's interesting about that, though, and I respect that, is I've seen that in boxing as well, where you have guys coming out of different fighting cultures come in. It's difficult to discern rhythms and things like that. And I think in a culture you can get in a homogenous state. Manny Pacquiao knocked down Juan Manuel Marquez three times in the first round that he fought in, and then they fought on even terms for three more fights because he just couldn't figure out exactly the rhythm and where that left hand was coming from. Pacquiao fought it from a Philippines culture completely differently. I know it's off topic, but I like that when you bring it with golf. With different sports, you can see this coming through, and there is training that leads to one way, and we're seeing much, obviously more Adam Dunn's these days. Yes, please.
I'm Chuck Hillebrand in Chicago. I like the war metric, but I don't really like the term war. Like, I like saying a player is a free win player, not really a free war player, because win sounds more oriented to the goal of the game. So it gets me to wondering whether the term war is a refining factor in the adoption of its use among fans. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are.
It makes it more mockable by fools.
Sure.
Yeah, that's all. That's it. And they can sing a song and do whatever they want. Is there a better way of coming up with the one true number, or whatever that one possible potential abstract true number is?
Or even more, what to call it.
Well, you know, sabermetricians have never been known for their marketing skills.
I think it's a good point. I mean, because it's something that you see it sometimes in kind of the discussion that goes back and forth with folks that are passionate about creating some kind of single metric, a single measure of value. So whether you agree with any of the three various versions of wins above replacement, if you don't even like the notion of replacement level, which you like wins above average or whatever that happens to be, I don't think it's a trivial point. I mean, there is a discussion about, the concept can be somewhat complex, but when you boil it down, people say, this guy helps us win more games than this guy. Well, not many people would have too hard a problem getting on board with that. But there is, and Vince makes a good point, when people are devising these things, the first thing they don't think of is, all right, we got these guys in the lab cooking up this really new product. All right, now we get the marketing, but let's get an agency in here. Let's get up a big campaign. They don't think about, we talk about data being digestible. How digestible is even the concept, right? So as we begin to kind of push that out from a small, or, and I say elite, not because they're smart, it's just elite, meaning there's just fewer of them that are kind of in the know on these concepts, and it has to begin to spread out. Certainly the adaptability of that will come down to the what do you call it and how hard is it to kind of get behind that. I think more and more what I've seen, though, is I think just by nature people have begun just to use the term wins. You peel that back and it's wins above what, relative to what, is it average, is it replacement level? But I think little by little, to your point, you've almost seen people do that naturally. It's just easier for me to talk about it in terms of wins. That's really what we're kind of discussing here. And I get more with my friends, my uncle, my mom, everyone can get more on board with that, and so we just begin to use the term. But yeah, the marketing, you never think about that. We throw an acronym together and this looks really neat, and people end up using it.
Look at the individual pitching win, right? The branding of it's a win, but isn't the object a win? I face this, every day. Go ahead, please.
Bill, by the way, Bill's doing pretty well. He's already down to trying to sell his mom and stuff. That's good.
Next question.
Steve Ferencik from Wynwood, Pennsylvania. And if war changes, it should be soon, because I just read the Topps is going to put it on the back of baseball cards next year.
Yes.
Sort of hard to believe.
So here's a question, though. I've heard this, but what version? Does anyone know?
B-War.
It's going to be?
Yeah.
It's showing.
Baseball Reference War.
So there's a good article by Gabe Kapler in the WPBI website a couple of years ago. It's worth Googling if you haven't seen it. About 2 weeks ago, called Stats 101. And he talks about how players don't have the information about the metrics that are being used to measure them. And so my question is, how do you get that out to players? Is it the job of the GMs? Is it the agents for the players? What's the best way for players to learn what is being used to evaluate them? And also some of the things that Vince is working on to show them how to act in the situation, or managers?
They're definitely getting the younger players. I think Gabe, and I spoke to Gabe, we've had him on the radio and been back and forth with him on Twitter. But I know he was even citing the players that he played with. Those guys are old already. So it's so much faster. The younger guys that we speak to are so hip to the process and not just the outcome. They're much, so there is kind of even a generation gap probably between the 23-year-old and the 33-year-old already. I think it's fast.
FanGraphs is a must-read for a lot of players. I mean, they're self-selecting in. A quick story that AJ Hinch told when he was managing the Diamondbacks and Max Scherzer was on the mound. Max Scherzer was very much into this, and Max had just given up two first-inning home runs, and he went out and he said, went out to the mound, made an unusual manager trip to the mound in the first inning. He said, Max, you okay? Max goes, yeah, are you kidding me? He said, I'm not going to give up another home run for another three games. He says, haven't you seen my home run for fly ball rating? So some of these guys are really into it.
Thank you for the question. Next, we'll reel some off here.
Hi, David Spiegel from New York. I want to go back to my question relates to the explosion of data, the accessibility of data, and the implication for how useful that is then at player level. Going back to the example before that you were talking about in terms of Robinson Cano was 8-for-20 off of C.J. Wilson. You can draw these heat maps, and then as you talked about the idea that you can now have this more dynamic look at what was the sequencing. The challenge that I'm wrestling with, and I wonder what your reaction to this is for all the additional data we have, we don't have any more data points. That is, there's still the same, roughly the same number of games, same number of at-bats year to year, the same number of events. We just have so much more data about it. So if we get very fine about this issue, instead of the 8 for 20, which is, as you pointed out, a very small sample size already, and then we parse that further and say, well, of the 20 final pitch events, only 6 of them were in change-ups. Now we've made even a smaller sample size. You know, how much can we trust that? So how far can we really push, parsing the data smaller and smaller and smaller to the point where we don't know what we can really trust off the conclusions that we're looking at?
Well, that's a great question, David. And I think that one of the solutions to this dilemma, which is very real and very practical, because it's almost which dimension do you want? Do you want sample size and breadth, or do you want depth in terms of, specificity? So I think where this goes is it goes to pooling data, to clustering, to looking at not just Robinson Cano against that, or not just C.J. Wilson, depending on who's doing the looking. It's looking at people like C.J. Wilson also, and using those data points, or from the other side, Cano.
There's always this uniqueness problem that's running through everything. As soon as you start aggregating just the change-ups, every change-up is different. Every pitcher's change-up is different. You got a circle change, you got the kind of wipe down your palm, Los Angeles Dodgers kind of change. There are all kinds. I pitched for 21 years in hardball, and I tried everything I could do, okay? And they're all different. They move in different directions, and the wind is a factor. As a lefty, if it was blowing from right to left, from behind home plate, I might as well just put my curveballs on and tee for the guy. Because I couldn't get it to break in that situation. So all of these things are unique, and you've got that problem wrapped inside this whole thing. So you got to be really careful when you start aggregating data, because this guy's fastball isn't this guy's fastball, and so forth. So, it's there are diminishing returns at some point.
Well, this gets back to the issue in terms of the error, the signal and the noise, and as you parse this smaller. And I agree, clustering is a great way to get around that, because then you're enlarging at the same time you're cutting it down, but still, if you've got that central tension, where you don't know how much is noise and how much is signal.
We got to go. Next question, please. I want to get everybody involved here. Go ahead.
So I watch baseball now a lot. And is Harold Reynolds really that obtuse, or is it just elegant?
We are what we say we are. We're not acting. There's no acting. I'm actually aggravated. I'm aggravated right now that you brought it up. Thank you. I'm only kidding. Harold and I live tweeted it. We went to dinner at TikTok Diner. We had no arguments. We thought, what are we doing wrong exactly? We just have to stop, overanalyzing. Yes, next. But I'm glad you're watching the show. Thank you.
Steven Silverman from Westchester, Pennsylvania. You mentioned a couple of times that 2 and 3 pitch sequences that pitchers often use. Have you given any thought to what would happen if pitchers and catchers start using random sequences, selecting the quadrant on a pitch 10 or 20 of them ahead of time before the inning starts, and going out for a run, and how will that impact?
Interesting, kind of the Bill Walsh approach, right? He used to script the first 25 plays of his game. I haven't given a lot of thought to that, but that's fascinating.
Yeah, kid, way to bring it. Well, I like that. We're messing with you now. That's right. I like that. Go ahead, you got a follow up, kid. Go ahead. You're good. All right, good. That's a one kid to listen. Yes. I don't know. I mean, look, it's fascinating. I mean, to get the Bloomberg data, and one of the things I started probably 8 years ago at this point, it's all the Bloomberg data, is to see what the probability was of a pitch after a certain pitch. And I'm sure they combat that now because they're all aware of that within there. But I haven't heard anything about going, pitch sequencing, because with each count, things change so exponentially, right?
Well, there's a lot of things that I love the idea, right? Because if you and for those of you who haven't seen it, Matt Schwartz, who also writes with me at Fangraphs, he consults. He did a great study. I think it was this year at the Sabre Analytics Conference on game theory. So how do you apply game theory to batter pitcher matchups? And so part of it was this idea of when you're in a batter pitcher matchup, a lot of, not to say that batters are just randomly guessing, but they are thinking about, given this pitcher's tendencies, given the situation, the base out state in the game, given what they've already thrown me, given the count, what is this pitcher most likely to throw me? Because again, like you said, you've got that's less than a split second to determine swing and not swing. So to some extent, there is that guesswork going on, and so the batter and the pitcher are kind of in that dance with each other. So one way to combat that, if you're a pitcher, is to say, I'm abandoning everything the data tells me in terms of, well, in this pitch, it's more of a fastball count versus a ball speed count, whatever. I'm just flip a coin and throw whatever, or we're going to script it. And so to some extent, scripting it, that might work early in the game. But one of the interesting things is, we have to take into account, the strike zone isn't set. So if I'm a pitcher, I recently looked at this just in terms of the very edge of the strike zone, but there's been a lot of work on this around how the strike zone changes, how the called strike zone changes based upon runners on, outs in the inning, the inning itself, the pitch you throw. There's so many factors where that strike zone is kind of amorphous and it shifts from situation to situation. So it could also be, I'll throw the batter off, but I also may put myself in a worse position because I'm not throwing the optimal pitch in the right location, given the count and the base out state to actually get the call strike. So, but I love the idea. Let's just make it completely random or just script it and see how that might mess with people's heads.
Yeah, except here we go. We got to get back to reality. The actual pitchers, human beings on the mound. If, say, a guy is a two-pitch pitcher, which most relievers are, you're not going to have too much opportunity to randomize that. Now, let's take the guy with four pitches. The typical starter, anywhere from three to five different pitches in his repertoire. He's not equally good at all of those. So if you start having him randomize these, he might be throwing his third or fourth best pitch more often than he would choose to. So you're starting to mess around again with the uniqueness of the individual, what his strengths and weaknesses are. If you're Pedro Martinez, and you've got four pitches, and they're all excellent, and you can throw them out where you want to, then you can play the random game. But he and Greg Maddux are about the only two pitchers I can think of off the top of my head who could give you that degree of consistency with all of their pitches.
Maybe Darvish.
But I'll tell you though, I really do think for a fifth starter, okay, somebody who doesn't have out stuff anyway, I mean, maybe the element of surprise at least gives that person to have a chance. I mean, there's two ways to look at it.
Good question, though.
You got six pitches.
You don't have to read all the pitches.
Yeah. All right, we got to go. That good question that you made us think. Very good job. Next.
It's first in Charlottesville, Virginia. Dr. Frank Jones already mentioned. Am I right that the percentage of pitchers each year in the majors would have Tommy John surgery is increasing? Is that correct? And does anybody know what percentage? Anyway, my question—I've heard that. I think that's true. And if that's true, do you foresee a time when 50% or more have had that kind of surgery or whatever, because we're cutting edge with increased medical knowledge and so forth?
As a guy whose elbow went in college. If I had stayed at it for another year or two, I probably would have needed that surgery.
And
in my case, it was because my arms don't go out all the way. I have a little bit of a declivity in this arm. So if you're not built to have that kind of hyperextension over and over and over again, you're going to fall apart. So medicine may be able to anticipate who some of these people are.
That's what
and
I'm
so that would cut
it down. It's having proactive.
You're seeing it now. You're seeing people getting prophylactic Tommy John at young ages, high schoolers.
Exactly. It would seem like the economic pressure then would be on more and more for that percentage to go up and up to the point where it reaches.
Maybe it would be considered a performance enhancing surgery.
Yeah, no, you get that. No, exactly. Okay, get a couple muscles in there. Yeah, like I don't use this one. You just put it there. Yeah. No, and DNA, sure. I mean, we're going down that road. Next question, please. We've got to keep going. Thank you. Next.
My premise is to bring all players with a given number of what you term as lifetime. Based on it, bats, runs, hits, doubles, triples, homers, RBIs, stolen bases, walks, and any other statistic that might fit. What is the best, and no matter how you use formula, Babe Ruth is probably going to be number one, but what is the best type of formula to use?
For offensive production?
Career level.
Career level. Dick, you want to, what is it, to do one number for all-time greatness?
That's there are many opinions in this area. Fortunately, the answer, I mean, if there were a clear answer, then there wouldn't be many opinions. but you can find, you know, there are many good sources. I would say, I couldn't really recommend a book. I have my own favorite, but I don't want to be a geek up here. So, but then let's talk afterward, and I'll refer you to something.
There we go. Next question, please, because we can get people through here. We'll get everybody a chance. Go ahead, please, sir.
How do we develop a measurement to accurately assess players' ability to make adjustments?
It's a great question because if you look at, because of some of the data that we have now, we're able to show things like, and I'm only citing myself because it's what I can remember. I just come off a vacation with my children, and it was a great weekend, but in the sun and everything else, I'm shot. We're able to show now, so for example, we know the physical impact of aging on pitchers. As their velocity declines, so too does their ability to affect outcomes in a positive way for them and for their team. But you see, for example, starters, as their velocity declines, their performance, like say strikeouts, it declines, it doesn't decline sharply. And so if you look at the pitchers that are above average in that regard, you kind of infer, well, those are the guys that are learning to adjust, right? So they're learning that I don't have that kind of, you know, strikeout, challenging down the center of the plate stuff anymore. So now I've learned how to nibble, I've learned how to use the edges more, I've moved to a cutter, more of a two-seam, or I can move it more, I can use pitch sequences better. But how do you determine ahead of time when this kid with a 96-mile-an-hour explosive fastball and just a wipeout curve, when that fastball goes, will they be able to adjust? That's a key question. I think there's a couple of ways that you can approach that. One way that we've traditionally always tried to do that is when scouts talk about makeup. What's this kid's makeup? When you talk about makeup, there's a lot wrapped up in that. One of which is, do they have the ability and the maturity to be able to adjust when things don't go their way, when those physical tools they've relied on start to deteriorate? There are a lot of ways to do that, and there's, you know, you can just pick the tons of different psychometric types of measurements out of thin air and apply them and say, okay, I can predict what kids have greater or lesser propensity to be able to adapt when their physical gifts start to betray them, and that can make all the difference. But finding that right tool, and you know, I'm biased because the company I work for will do that, so I'm not going to get into who's better or worse. I like ours, but that's one way that teams could do that. What's the success rate on that? I think that it's greater or less depending upon the domain, but also depending upon the measure you're using. That, I think, is, if there was a frontier for me, more so than what we've seen already with some of the, you know, the sensor data, that's one of the big frontiers. Because if you can predict who are those guys that will have that maturity, have the ability to adapt, be more coachable, you can take two players with similar talent levels, and you can make an even better decision about who to draft, who to bring in the club. And given the rules that are imposed about salary control, that's huge for teams. So I think it's an excellent question. I don't think there's a ready-made answer as of yet. I think that's still a big moving target, and that's still a frontier area of analytics at this point.
If we want all three to go, and make it 30 seconds quick. All three, we'll go all three and go.
Was Bob Gibson's 1968 anywhere near Pedro 99 or Pedro 2000? And can anyone explain why on a good team he managed to lose 9 games that year?
Yeah, the win-loss means virtually nothing, not absolutely nothing, but very, very little. I'd have to really study and see what, obviously his run prevention was terrific, but in an incredible, a depressed run scoring environment. I'd have to look, I'm sure it's there somewhere. Just Pedro was doing a 1.74 ERA in the highest run scoring environment. Anybody else know where Gibson would land in the 68 season? Yeah, no, it's up there, but you'd be surprised. Again,
it's way up there. He had a 1.12 ERA, but the league ERA was 2.99. So his relative improvement over the norm was not as great as Pedro's.
Yeah, Louis Tion, Sam McDowell had monstrous years in 68 as well that weren't that far off. That said, yeah, it's certainly up there. Yes?
I'm from Fort Collins, by the way.
I've been thinking about trying to simplify the question, and it comes down to this. Do you think that war is a better summer than the
I'll give you my answer. I think I'm alone on this. War started to come up in salary discussions in the Players Association. And so they stuck it into their system so we would have access to one of the burdens of war. So as I got ready to prepare an arbitration case, I had to ask myself, well, if the other side brings out war, and I don't know which of the burdens, how am I going to debunk that? Because I don't want to get into that. It's complicated, and I think it has a lot of problems. So, there are a couple others that agree.
It's a question of war includes what was already referred to, durability. You know, if you're producing a pretty high level over some period of time, rather than a really high level over a short period of time, we've seen a lot of that in Philadelphia lately. Unfortunately, there are trade-offs, and so they're really apples and oranges to some degree. What do you care about, durability or highest possible performance? That's the question.
Yeah, and all that I would say is that you want OPS tells you hitting. What about base running and fielding? You know, you want base running and fielding. If anybody comes up with one number, this would be the room to do it, that can tell you definitively what the total contribution is of a player, sell us on it. We'll dine on it, you know, and we'll take it. If it's win shares, if it's war, whatever it is it perfect? No. Is it the enemy? No. It's an exceptionally useful tool when you realize that offensive war, correct me if I'm wrong, I think is extremely accurate. Defensive war, really take a look and see what the evidence is actually telling you. Maybe you believe it, maybe you don't. But nobody's a slave to it. Nobody credible that I know of is a slave to it. No, this is his war and he's better than this guy. But it brings everything into play, and don't we want that?
Yeah, but see, here's aside from some of these specific technical questions, there's the question of the definition of a replacement player. In preparing for this thing, months ago, I contacted somebody who had a website online, and it was the only place where I found commentary on a book that I'd written in 1989, so I thought, let's see what's going on. So I found the guy, I'm not going to name him. We engaged in a 20-page exchange by email on the whole business of war, all of its various parts. And the biggest problem he had was telling me what a replacement player is. I said, is it all the guys who don't have enough service yet and they actually are replacing somebody?
Isn't it a guy that you would get for the minimum salary?
Well,
the best player, a guy you're going to AAA. It's an economic model, right?
That was one definition I read of it, which is the lowest paid players, both in terms of straight up contracts and also by way of trades, the people you would pay the least for. But here's the problem. You've got players who are borderline major leaguers who will never get a full-time job in the major leagues. Is that a replacement player? Or is it a guy at the end of the bench, a utility player who you're going to keep around for a few years because he's kind of adequate and you can fill in if you need him? And so there's no firm definition of it, but the really troublesome part of it was I said to him, at the end of the day, what's the concept? How can I know, after a season's over, what the replacement level is? And he said, well, it's subjective. I said, appealing. So that means any war stat that I'm reading, the bottom line, the replacement player level, has been determined arbitrarily each year. And I have no idea how to replicate that, how to test it.
All right, let me stop you there. Bill, you want to answer that? Because you're bringing to light both sides of an email debate that only you have knowledge to. Yes, please.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably not the best person to answer this in terms of the mechanics of war at that level, and this work, and Sean, the former, had been perfect. What I would say is this. I wouldn't say that it's completely arbitrary. I think that whether you are, you know, whether you're Baseball Reference, whether you are, you know, Fangraphs, which have now united essentially, have a common sort of replacement level, they're not necessarily sort of picking it out of thin air. They are looking at, you know, devising a way to say, if you had an entire team filled with this, these level of players, so there are those players that are available on the waiver wire, those quad A players that, again, they get a cup of coffee in the majors, or they can stick around a little bit and be somewhat useful. You know, if you were to field an entire team of these people, what would that team's performance at the end of the year usually be? And again, it's been a while, so there's been some changes. It's been anywhere between, you know, 420 winning percentage to 320 winning percentage. And then that allows you to then compare, well, then what happens if you had a team that was filled with players that were, you know, again, they played at a higher level than those players. To say that it's arbitrary, again, I think you can to somewhat pick whatever baseline that you want. That allows you to compare relative value. But I wouldn't say it's arbitrary in the sense that they're literally just picking out of the hat every single season. I think it just gives the wrong connotation to it, that it's much more random and has less thought put into it than it actually does. But the idea that you have to go out and pick someone and say, you are the embodiment of a replacement level, we can go find those players and try to just kind of say, hey, that's somebody who really does everything a little bit below average, and so again, you can kind of find them wherever for a cheap price and plug them in if you absolutely had to and had nobody else in your farm system that could play at a higher level. But I think it's less about being able to go out and point to who embodies the great replacement level, and it's more about saying, how do we establish a baseline where we can measure how, you know, two similar players perform on a relative basis.
Yeah, where is the baseline?
I'm talking about, we can continue afterwards. How about one more? Last question. There's four guys standing there the whole time. Go ahead. Last question.
I'll try and make this quick. I was just wondering if this had ever been studied in conclusions. Does it help Herbert hitters to build up these huge muscular arms, big biceps, big triceps? I mean, does it mess up more people than it helps?
It tends to hurt because the speed of the bat is the critical ingredient, and it's your ballistics, not your raw strength, that determines how quickly you can swing that bat. And this is from ligamentous tissue, not from muscle mass. So it's your tendons and your ligaments. So this is how a Darryl Strawberry could be a tape measure home run hitter. Skinny as a rail, but, you know, really good ligamentous tissue and ballistics capabilities. So the more you build up, the less speed you have, and you've given up your edge.
I think training has become much more scientific. I think most guys at the top level do sports-specific training now, whereas Rod wasn't all that long ago. Guys were just doing bodybuilding exercises and getting huge, you know, many different means, obviously. Just in the way, but you got to put in the work too. But yeah, you see guys are leaner now and have some powerful cores, and that's, you have, you know, also have you wearing down of your obliques. You know, most guys, what's an oblique? Well, when you develop them, you can straighten them, and that's what they do. I think we're good. Are we good? I want to invite Eric.